through everything up.
Are you missing the clouds?
Can't find any. They're all gone.
There's some over there. Some low clouds over there. Okay, so we're going to record it anyway, because I normally don't give you a chance to start doing it.
Thanks for that.
So we've got Helm in Australia near an island where we just had a couple of steak sandwiches. Scott got to see a kangaroo, which was nice. Was it exciting?
First time. It was a small. It was a baby kangaroo.
It's a wallaby.
What are they called? Oh.
Yeah, it's a wallaby.
Is a wallaby a baby kangaroo, or is a wallaby not a kangaroo?
It's different. Okay. They're like kangaroos, but they're babies.
Had big feet, though.
Had like talons on the bottom of it, like about this. And mind you, this was only like a little wallaby, like, I don't know, a couple of foot high or something.
Still had like 3-inch
massive talons.
Velociraptor claws, though.
So you got the wallaby today, got the dolphin yesterday.
Yeah, and it was hunting. That was cool.
And you got a stingray just then. Yes. Except it disappeared when it saw you. That's what they do.
It's like shiny white legs.
So Scott's come down to Australia a couple of days ago. You're in India. How's India?
India was good. I wasn't there long, actually. I didn't get to really see as much of India as I wanted. First time I've ever been. It was a lot easier to get a business visa and go there than anywhere else I've ever been. It's just like, you want to come? Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
But no, it was cool to see, like... everything's just so big over there. Like, the campus I was working on was like a tech campus, and like loads of office blocks, and just like so many people. It's like, yeah. I've never been to a place where there's like so many people in one place, and that was really...
Definitely not here.
Like, yeah. That was one of the really obvious things.
Okay, so Scott's here because we're going to NDC next week. In fact, we're going to NDC on Sunday, so NDC in Sydney. So this will be the Australian edition of the London and the Oslo ones that we've done this year. Which will be good. So we'll go down to Sydney on Monday and do that. Sunday.
Yeah, we do that. Yeah.
I just follow my trip. follow the trip. So I'll do a couple of days of workshops, and then we've got, 3 days of conference where we're doing Cyberbroken talk again last thing on Friday, which in Oslo, like, consistently people going like, this was the best talk of the whole thing.
Yeah, that was nice. It's good to hear that back.
Yeah, it was nice. I think it was because we drank beer.
I thought you were joking when you said that.
Were you?
And then you rocked up with
camera. Oh, I was going to bring beer.
Yeah.
You don't know me very well. anyway, we'll do that next week. And of course, PubConf. So you're going to do PubConf?
Yeah, apparently. I signed up for it, told about it afterwards.
Can you remember what you called your PubConf talk?
Make Australia Great Again.
No, it wasn't that. Can't remember.
Oh, no, it was Make Australia. Sorry, that was the first idea. It's Make Australia Great Britain Again.
I didn't put great in. I just put... I gave
just make Australia Britain
title.
Again.
Anyway, we should actually get on to talking about something useful. All right, so I got a bunch of notes on my laptop over here. And this morning I spoke at .NET Conf, which is the Microsoft Online conference, which will probably be wrapped up, I think, by the time this video goes out. But they did record everything. It's going to be on Channel 9 later on. So I spoke about things with Have I Been Pwned on Azure, mostly about how cool functions are, particularly compared to the old PaaS model, and also a lot about Cloudflare, which of course you've been spending a lot of time on as well.
Yeah.
Spoke a lot about sort of just massively reducing traffic to the origin using Cloudflare, and also spoke about workers, because workers are a really cool way of sort of rolling over from one old paradigm to a new paradigm and keeping the same URLs. So I wanted to make sure that when I rolled over my API... I caught that.
That would have been so much better if there'd have been like a massive splash right afterwards.
And then I went in. Show's not over yet, man. Well, that looked good.
Workers.
So I've been using them to roll over the API so that I can keep the old URL and not break it for anyone else. But instead of hitting web API running in an Azure app service, it now hits Azure Functions. Totally different host name, different PaaS. And the worker is just going to do the magic of getting the request as it goes through to Cloudflare and then sending it to a different location. So I think we're both kind of in love with workers.
It's just so easy.
Yeah, and not like to be clear, and I think most people that know us or listen to these things know that it's not a contrived, Cloudflare's putting dollars in the bank because of this. Like, they are just genuinely awesome.
Yeah, it's made things with Report Your Eye so much easier as well. We're saying the other day about you doing kind of like rolling traffic from one origin to the other on Azure, and we're using it to rewrite JSON on the way in so that we don't have to change all of our ingestion code. It's
Yeah.
It's just super convenient.
Yeah.
Super convenient.
Everything about them's nice. I think that the two things that really stick out to me as patterns is serverless, so we never think about servers with that. Yeah. And the other thing being traffic flow control on the edge, where there's this premise of, look, you've got 152 data centers around the world today where your code runs. And all you do is you just, like, you literally go control S and it's now there, 152 data centers, which is kind of cool. All right, what do I have next? This is a good one for you, actually, good timing for you. Chrome changing UI and then changing UI again. So
yeah.
Do you want to explain what happened in Chrome 69 originally, and we'll talk about why they made that change, and we can talk about reverting it.
Yeah, so 69, I guess the first big one was the removal of the secure chip for most websites to go down to just the padlock instead of padlock secure. The padlock also went from green to grey, which was another nice one. They removed the HTTPS scheme from, I think they call it the Omnibox, the address box for most of us. So instead of like https://choihunt.com, it was just like choihunt.com. But then I guess the big one was for you, it would have been www.choihunt.com because you use the www. But they started to remove and simplify the subdomains. So the www and m, usually for like mobile versions of sites and things. So they hid those from the address bar as well.
So I think it's, and we got to talk about them sort of then rolling some of that back, but to establish a few things first, because I suspect you noticed, as I did, that some people lost their minds about this.
Someone on the internet lost their mind.
There was a lot of mind losing, and there's a few things to be clear about, and number one is that this has no impact on DNS. So I saw some people going, well, what if I don't, you know, have correct DNS entries for www? Like, basically thinking that there was something mechanically different, but this is just aesthetics, right? It's like one client deciding we're going to do things this way.
We're just going to change slightly how a big long string of text appears.
Yeah.
That's basically all they did.
Which is all it was, really. I had a lot of people say this will make it harder because if you can't see, say, the www, how do you know that you're on the www and then not the naked domain? And I guess what I'm struggling to understand is
why that matters.
Why it matters.
Like, there's so many times when I've gone to a website and been like, oh, I'm not on the www, I must be on the wrong website.
My gut feel, and I guess recognizing that we're in a bit of an echo chamber of technical people who pay attention to this sort of thing, they're sort of going, look, I am actually interested as a technical person in knowing this. And to be fair, you can toggle this, right, in your Chrome settings.
You can. And also, I still can't see
the point is that if you're a technical person and you look for this and you want to see it, you could toggle it and show it.
But wouldn't it be easy to just click in the address box, which brings it all back?
Well, okay, so there's the other thing. Clicking in the address box does actually show the scheme, and it shows the www.
The full URL, yeah.
And likewise, if you were to copy the address, it's all in the copied text. So, you know, there's that. I guess that the theme that I felt, and we didn't really talk about this, but the theme I felt is that people were very much judging this based on what it meant to them as a technical person, and sort of missing the fact that there's hundreds of millions, billions of other people.
Probably billions, yeah.
Using Chrome who just have got no idea about what the www is. Now, at the time, one of the things that I was sort of saying to people is, look, you may not agree with it, but at least appreciate that Google puts a huge amount of research into this and they make these decisions based on a lot of evidence. And you and I both saw Emily Schechter's talk in Hawaii.
It's like April sometime, yeah.
April, somewhere thereabouts. April, May? Yeah, April, because you were here, May. And it was just interesting to hear about sort of how much research goes into this stuff. Like, this is not made lightly, right? Not a decision made lightly. So one of the other things that I heard is it's going to make phishing easier. So how does it make phishing easier?
Again, it's one of those things where if a person is on like the wrong version of the website, as if like the websites have different content on the www or on the bare domain, then I can't explain it. So I really just don't understand. I guess I really don't understand what the point was. Like,
because you got to kind of stretch. I think I think it was basically something to do with, and if, look, if someone has an actual good evidence-based reason as opposed to because it just doesn't feel good, you know, please chime in. But it was just something to do with, look, not being able to see the entire URL, therefore you can't make an informed opinion. And I think to sort of draw this around the other way and go, okay, well, why would you do this? It's because people don't read the URL.
Yeah.
And to be fair as well, it's not just that they don't read the URL, it's that they have trouble interpreting the URL.
Parsing it is hard.
And we've seen things like that Apple.com Punycode IDN, you know, which looks just like Apple.com in Firefox because Firefox renders the native, I think they're acrylic characters, some of them. Looks identical to Apple. I mean, you know, to sort of say to people, was it Cyrillic?
You said acrylic.
No, did I say? I sort of like, said acrylic. Like, no, I said
thought
acrylic.
You said acrylic. I was like there was some little cut-out plastic.
Is this another
character.
Foot gun? Anyway, Google it. No, so I think that people are very, very terrible at reading the URLs. In fact, Google knows this, that they certainly have a lot of evidence on this. One of the things that popped up during the week that I shared and seemed to get a lot of traction was, and I think you saw this, was a little video that showed a Google phishing attack where someone's clicked the link and it's like a Google window that pops up.
Oh, that was Mustafa.
Was it?
I think it was Mustafa, yeah. I think I saw that.
If you looked at the address bar, it was like, you know, account.google.com. And then if you grabbed the window and you stretched it out to make the address bar go further, it was like account.google.com.evilcyberhacker.com.
Yeah.
You know?
That was really well
so
done.
So just using subdomains and then sizing the window just perfectly. And I think the point about all this is that people are just terrible at parsing information in URLs. And we all are to one extent or another, because you or I would just as easily be fooled by a lot of these names. Like, let's not think that we've got any sort of great talent about this sort of stuff. Now, everyone did a bit of mind losing, and then Google rolled a bunch of stuff back. So
So they put the www subdomain back, the m subdomain, what they call, I think they call them simple subdomains or something. There's a term that they use, right? But they put those back, and I believe they put the scheme back as well. Now, last time I looked at mine, and I honestly get the feeling that that was more just to placate people.
Yep.
Maybe they tried to do too much at once, and because people lose their minds, we need to go a little bit slower.
It's interesting, right. Isn't it? Now, I am mostly supportive of Google because I think they put a lot of research into it, but the one bit I'd be critical about is I really don't think they communicated this very well.
No, the subdomain change was probably, like, as everyone pretty much knew, the secure chip and the padlock thing was coming because it was in the Chrome security blog months ago.
But let me qualify that. I don't just mean saying, hey everyone, we're changing your browser on you. I would love to see them communicate why. I'd love to see them be able to go, here are all the studies we're doing, this is the evidence, this is what we can learn from this, this is why we're doing it. Because I understand why there was mind losing about that. I mean, why don't they just go, here's the case studies, here's the user groups, the focus groups.
I can understand why there was mind losing in that I understand the kind of things that people lose their mind at, but I don't think it was...
move their cheese, right?
Yeah, I don't think it was worth losing your mind over. And one of the things that I kind of come back to a lot is, you know, if you take a full URL and you could only have one part of it to try and help you, which part would you take? Assuming you broke it into its core components.
Yeah, it would be the domain name.
It would be the registrable domain every time. And I always kind of come back to that in that it is the most useful part in trying to, you know, for someone to try and understand, is this the right place?
But to hold you to account to the original question, why doesn't Google share the research or share the information which quantifies or qualifies rather why they've done this? Is it something that they're needing to protect, for example?
Yeah, I mean, maybe, I don't know, would there be a commercial reason? I don't know,
I struggle to find it.
I don't think there would be, because everyone's going to see what the change is, so the reason for the change is less important. Like if Google does this thing and everyone can just copy that idea anyway, kind of thing.
Well, they've reverted a few things. There's still no secure and it's still not green. So
yeah, that's good.
The last final thing on this before we move on. Look, I think it's good in terms of simplifying it. Now, all those corporate policies out there that tell everyone to look for the green padlock and the secure text before logging on.
Well, did you see my tweet on that?
No.
It's like every corporate website ever, like, look for the green padlock and then Chrome, hold my beer. We've just broken everyone's corporate policies on stuff.
Fair enough. So that's screwed those guys up. All right. You know, I don't know why I put this note here. Personality and InfoSec transcends tech. Do you know why I put that in there?
No.
Okay, move on.
Next one. Next. We'll circle back.
Fresh menu in India. Now, this is an interesting one. So Fresh Menu had a data breach. There was 100 something thousand unique email addresses in there. And this was, I think I mentioned last week, I was processing about half a dozen breaches at the same time. And this was one of the ones where I was going through this data. I'd verified it, it's legitimate, trying to get in touch with the organization. And I sent a few messages. I did get a response from them fairly early, to their credit, much more so than some of the other ones I've loaded this week. And that was good, but what very quickly emerged is that they knew about the data breach and they hadn't disclosed it. And this is always enormously frustrating for me because I really want to tell them some fairly honest things, if I'm honest. We'll get to shaming. Their defense was that there was no credit card data in there, but it was names, email addresses, physical addresses, phone numbers, order histories.
The defense of not sharing it?
Yeah. Well, when we say not sharing it, not disclosing it.
So they think that the only thing that people care about was the credit card number, so it wasn't important.
Don't think it's that they think the only thing people care about. I think they felt that the only thing that would compel them to actually disclose the fact that they'd stuffed something up. And also, this was all JSON, probably out of MongoDB, basically logs, right? Because it was order logs, and, you know, in this new modern world of denormalized databases in JSON format, there's just everything in there for every single record. So anyway, they hadn't disclosed it, and I published the data breach, and I made a comment in the data breach of, I have been in touch with them, they elected not to disclose. And someone from Fresh Menu, I don't think that's what it is, but someone from Fresh Menu got in touch with me afterwards, and they sort of said, look, can you please let people know that the underlying vulnerability has now been fixed and that no cards were compromised? And I went back to them and I said, and this was a private discussion, so I won't tell you exactly what I said, but the general theme of it was, that's the sort of thing you put in a disclosure notice, right? It's like, okay, we had a data breach, here's what happened. We fix the underlying problem and your credit cards are okay. I mean, we see this all the time, right? It's like, no, credit cards, yada, yada, yada. And I said, you know, that should be in your breach. And I said, look, I'm happy to make that update. What should I say about you not notifying people? And then the crickets started. And I didn't, this was several days ago.
The way to back them, like, into the corner on answering that question.
Well, because...
Yeah, but you've got to push the answer.
Well, my position on it was that if you're going to keep towing this line of not disclosing to people, I'm going to make a point of you not wanting to disclose to people. When I got up this morning, my Google Alerts had a couple of news stories about Fresh Menu, and they did actually end up disclosing. Their CEO, I believe, put out a message which was reasonable. It was very, very light on technical detail, but it did apologize and say, look, you know, they value customers, so good on them.
Take security seriously.
I think they're now taking security seriously. But this was just another one of these cases, and this this is going to segue well into something later on, but it was another one of these cases where they needed to be held to account in order for them to do the right thing. You know, I mean, that they... I was going to say, depending on your jurisdiction, I suspect India doesn't have mandatory disclosure laws, but if you're in India and you know they do, then leave a comment and let me know. But I felt that they sort of felt they could get away with this. And once it is in the public domain, well, you can't get away with this.
And do you think that's just like old school thinking, though? Because...
I wonder if there's a bit of a cultural difference as well. I mean, we're seeing all this discussion about Aadhaar at the moment, and of course you would have seen all this...
We talked about that whilst I was there, because the breach happened.
Well, no, it's unbreachable. I don't know.
The unhackable thing.
They have literally...
Was it an incident? It wasn't a breach.
They have literally said the data is secured behind a 13-foot high wall. Have you seen that comment?
Seriously. I have not. Is it a cyber
wall? No, they actually build a wall. No, not a cyber wall.
But then did they put the cable through the wall? I don't understand why a wall helps.
That was one of the comments. It's the communication on behalf of the Indian government's just been terrible, but I suspect part of it is cultural in that it is, and now, of course, you've been there and I haven't, so I'm making some assumptions here, but it always appears to be a very hierarchical, class-based structure where the leadership is questioned less than what we might do so here.
Yeah,
in the
that's
UK.
Really, like in the offices and walking around the campus and things, there's like a, like, you can really see that as you walk around. It's one of the things that I picked up on, just like, wow. And, you know, even like in the hotel staff,
yep.
Like, if the manager walks through, the bellboy would be like, oh,
yeah,
yes.
Right.
And it, you know, it's just and like, wow, like... this is really weird.
Anyway, so, look, that's all worked out okay. Now, Fresh Menu has disclosed. Now, you made the comment about data incident. So, Vima who I didn't know of before, has not had a data breach. About 440 million records are out there, but it's not a data breach. It's a data incident. I shared this morning, and I wanted to try and find a quote from one of my talks, but I remember a few years ago, there was a company called RegPack had the same sort of thing, and they went out and said, this is not a breach, it's a data incident. And it's just, like, honestly, this is the sort of shit people just don't have patience for.
You know? It makes it sound like the data had an incident.
Had an accident.
It went and had a boo-boo in the corner or something. Oh, the data incident. Oh my God, I just said data as well. That's absolutely not acceptable.
Welcome to Australia. So that was those guys. Data. Now, we're going to come back and talk about the public shaming thing, because this is a blog post, and I'm going to leave the blog post to last. You and I were talking about CSPs this morning and CSP filtering. Mm. And the discussion we're having, and I kind of wanted to talk about this here because some people might have some input on it as well, is that when you go into report URI at the moment and you look at your reports, and if I look at like the Have I Been Pwned reports, there's always a bunch of stuff in there for things that aren't my fault. So it's not that my CSP policy is... Or CSP, is that like an ATM machine?
You can't have a CSP policy, dude.
It's not like my CS policy... That's weird.
That just sounds weird.
My CSP is malformed. I don't have cross-site scripting vulnerabilities, at least that I know of. Could be a data incident for all I know. I don't have these things, but I'm getting a lot of noise from extensions. And you and I were sort of having the discussion about what should be done in terms of the mechanics of how extension developers should work and then what we should do. Do you want to sort of share your views on this again?
Yeah, so it's a really tough problem. It's something that I think that we've put a lot of work into to try and get the filtering to where it is. So,
but you know, like, just explain what causes this in the first place.
Yeah, so the biggest cause that we see is some kind of extension on the browser. So, you know, you've got Chrome Firefox extension that's doing things to the page that it might be trying to like swap fonts, add scripts, change anything, because they can do whatever they want. And that then triggers the CSP. So the extension will inject a script into the page, and CSP is like, nope, this is not allowed. Block it, send a report. Now, the site operator can't do anything about that because it's on the client side.
Right, it's outside your control.
Yeah, so it's absolutely, like, once you've got the extension installed, the extension can do whatever it likes. So we kind of like try and filter those. We try and identify common extensions that do common things that are wrong, and then like filter the reports out. So if we see a common like script tag block, number one, we see it across all of our customers. So, you know, it's not just like one website has a problem. It's like, oh, all like every single one of our customers has the same problem. There's not every single one of our customers. It's that they have clients going to them that all have the same extension. So we identify that at a high level, our global vantage point that we have. And then we just start dropping those reports on the way in, because we know that if I tell you about it and it's like, okay, Troy, hey, on Have I Been Pwned, you've got this browser that has an extension that's screwing up the page. Great. Like, what do I do as the owner of the website? So we want to start removing as many of those as we can, because they're completely unactionable. And the difficulty then is, number one, identifying it, which we are getting better at, like in terms of what is a candidate to filter. But the really hard thing is getting the evidence to the point where you can say, I can remove this because no one anywhere wants to know about it. And that's really
because we don't want to take away something that could be useful to someone on the site. So the correct approach, like if in a technically perfect world, the extension developer would effectively whitelist the content types and sources and things that need to pull from, right?
Yep. So they just, okay, we want to inject the script tag, which loads from this CDN, parse the CSP and add an entry.
Yep.
Problem solved.
And you made the point earlier on, you said that they might just do it the cheap and nasty way and just delete the CSP altogether, because an extension can do this, right?
Yep.
And this calls into question something else I was sharing earlier on in the week, which got a heap of shares, which is that extensions in browsers have a huge amount of control.
Yeah.
You know, like you think about what you can actually do with a website and a browser, you're pretty limited, you're sandboxed by design. Someone writes an extension and it's got just crazy levels of access. And I think the context of why I was sharing it was because another one went rogue. So one of them, there was a usual injecting crypto miner sort of bullshit. But I was sort of making the point, you know, what if someone came, if you had a successful extension, let's say there's 50,000 people using it, someone comes along and says, we'll give you $10,000 for that extension. Are you as a user confident that the developer of that extension is not going to go, yeah, I'm going to take the cash, and then it goes rogue and your browser automatically updates? And so that's kind of a bit tangential to CSP. I guess the point is that the extensions have a huge amount of control. Yeah. My perfect world would be to try and guide extension developers down the path of best practice. So to sort of say, hey, you're writing an extension, you've got to pull some stuff in from another place. It's going to violate CSPs. You should whitelist yourself within that CSP, which won't break the CSP and it won't remove the CSP, and we won't then get violation reports.
And I agree, ideal world, but my fear is that people are just going to delete that. You know, as an extension developer, it's like, oh, well, number one, do they care? Like, does it, you know, like, I think...
Well, but shouldn't they care?
It might break the functionality of the extension.
Oh, so do they care that it's... All right, I think every extension developer, regardless of whether they're good dudes or bad dudes, would care that their extension is actually not working because the CSP is blocking it. And let's be clear, this is what's happening, right? When those violation reports come through, stuff has been blocked. That's why there's a report. If the extension was dependent on it, then it's broken.
So I wonder if that's the way to sell it then.
Yeah.
Like, not do the right thing. Like, you need to make sure that your extension is functional.
I think we've got to appeal to the fact that, you know, maybe, and what I put to you, and everyone should encourage Scott to do this, is that I think you should write a blog post about how extension developers should play nice with CSP.
Yeah.
And then what we do is, when we've got our customers of Report URI and they see this noise, it's like, hey, you're seeing this noise. It's from this extension. Send the extension developers to Scott's blog post and just tell them to get it right. Because if they get it right, then it's going to disappear for everyone.
And that also removes the risk of us having to safely categorize traffic as...
It obviously saves us work, but it's also work that should be
just the responsibility. I don't care. Like, the work is the work, but it's more like I really don't want to get that wrong, which is why sometimes it can take us so long to actively filter one, because it's not like, oh, yeah, this thing came in. We'll just... You know, there's a lot of time and research that goes in for me to figure out, can we remove this?
I think we should publicly shame those ones who aren't doing their extensions right, which leads us to the next thing. So again, it's just coincidental timing that you're here, but as one who has partaken in public shaming before, you're probably a good person to have around. I wrote a blog post about public shaming, and I wrote it because very often I have... like, let's take away the shaming word just for a moment and just define the pattern, because I think people get a bit carried away with this. But very often I've seen, let's say, some ridiculous security statement said. So the one that came to mind and I included in this blog post was NatWest over in your corner of the world, who someone had raised to them that the NatWest website wasn't served over HTTPS, it was HTTP. The link to the login page was over HTTPS, and NatWest was arguing that, you know, that, well, this is fine because when you enter your credentials, it's secure. But the problem is the pipeline of how people get there was not secure, so you could have been led to somewhere else. And at one point, I think I'd sort of said to them, and this was, it was on public Twitters, but it was just direct mentions. I'd said to them, you know, look, here is the reason why. And I'd linked them to something, and they replied and said, we're sorry you feel this way. And so basically they were saying they were sorry that I felt this way, that this is how the technology works. And I went, all right, well, you know, screw this. Quote tweet and said, look, that basically said something negative about NatWest. My feelings disagree with your feelings. And this meets the definition of what a lot of people are talking about with shaming, where they're saying, look, you're sort of trying to highlight to the world that this company's done the wrong thing or has the wrong view. That's a bad thing. And I wanted to write something that I can point people to, because I don't believe that. I don't believe that it's a bad thing to highlight this sort of incident or this sort of security posture publicly. And I wanted to use the word shaming because let's just turn the thing around. Like, if you want to call it shaming, fine, turn it shaming, but let's take that from being like a negative derogatory term to something that has a positive outcome.
And I think that's the thing for me, is that so many people have just a negative association with the word that... If you change the word for criticism, okay, so we're going to do some public criticism, I don't think anyone would care. Because public criticism is, like, perfectly okay.
That's not as emotionally charged if you just say criticism.
But that's all it is. You're pointing out the fact that they've done something wrong and that there's a better way, but you're not being hostile towards them.
Yeah, and this was sort of part of the point in the post as well. I don't think that saying shaming is okay is a catch-all to be a complete dick.
No.
And
that's just called being a dick.
Yeah, and in Australian death seagull. In fairness, like, this is subjective. Everyone has their own tolerances. I fully recognise that. But yeah, I think being polite and not abusive and constructive, even if it might be terse and it might be firm and it might be very direct, I'm quite okay with that. I'm quite okay, especially with the outcomes. And what I wanted to do in this blog post is sort of make the point that time and time and time again, after shaming, as we're calling it now, positive change happens. And very, very frequently, that positive change is from people inside the organization who always knew it was shit. And I sort of give a couple of examples there. I've spoken to people in the company and they said, thank you for the shaming. We couldn't get traction until it was public and until it looked bad and until it was in the press.
Yep.
It doesn't always work out that way. I mean, you had some shaming with Nomex. How'd that work out? Why aren't you in jail yet?
Nomex is so good.
Are you hiding behind the protection of Britain?
Yep. I'm still fleeing from the American police, I guess.
You know, in fairness, that's an interesting point to touch on too. I mean, Nomex, just Google Scott Helman Nomex, but they vehemently denied all of your claims and you know, were kind of dicks about it, to be honest. But this was, as best we can tell, sort of a one man and maybe a few blokes in a garden shed kind of structure as well. I mean, it's a bit different when it's Nat West. And it's also a bit different. I was going to say it's a bit different when everyone piles on, but let's face it, everyone piled on Nomex. Highlighting it publicly does cause this pile-on effect, and I think this might be one of the things that people are upset about, where they feel that there's like an angry mob. But frankly, in many of these cases, it deserves an angry mob. And this is not the same as like pitchforks and, you know, walking down the street.
Yeah. A few taps on a keyboard.
I had 90% plus positive feedback on Twitter. Probably a few more sort of neutral or negative ones on the blog as well, but yeah, overwhelmingly positive. Only one or two that got really upset about it, and I just, you know, it's like, okay, well, when you want to provide feedback, maybe you use a different word for it or do whatever you want to do. The last thing on this, so one of the things that popped up a bit is people were saying it's just a poor customer service rep, you know, like don't be angry at Sharon or whoever it is.
But then don't like publicly engage with people. But it's like, that's where you're supposed to give feedback, right? That's why we have members of staff that work for a company that interact with the company's like customers or the public. But that's where you're supposed to direct feedback, good or bad.
Right. This is like you're the customer service person.
Yeah.
You're called Sharon. We're saying, Sharon, here's how we feel about this. You know,
it's nothing to do with the person at the other side that's.
If you say, Sharon, I'm going to come to your house one day and watch you from outside, like, that's a different thing.
Yeah.
But this is not what's happening. I mean, this is just normal online communication.
Okay, so what if it was a chatbot?
I wouldn't be going to its house.
But, you know, what if you were actually tweeting to a chatbot and it was just scripting some answers and then you were yelling?
So your point is that once people sort of personalize it, that's when they get upset, when they go, hey, there's a real human being with feelings at the end of this.
But maybe there isn't. But then does that change anything? Like, you know, I'm still angry at the bank, not...
I think that the outcome of this is that we're not going to be doing anything differently on that shaming front, and hopefully other people feel a bit more empowered to do the same. All right, so, being conscious of time. I loaded a big whack of data last night, our time, nearly 42 million records worth. Now, this is from a service called Kayomo, KAYO.MOE. What TLD is .MOE?
.MOE?
.MOE.
I didn't... No, I only
it's
know
a thing.
Two letter ones.
And I kept mistyping it because I kept saying .ME because I just never heard of .MOE. If only there was a way to find out. Anyway, so this is a public anonymous free file sharing service. And the operator of that reached out to me earlier this week and said, look, someone's been dumping a huge number of files on here with credentials. And long story short, there was, I think, 750-odd files, about 1.8 gigabytes worth of credential stuffing data. And there was a bunch of it I hadn't seen. Now, to quantify, when I say a bunch of it, it was when I did my first test, about 11% or something of the email addresses weren't in Have I Been Pwned. It was another one in the same line as, like, Anti-Public and Exploit IN and all this stuff where it's just, bad dudes grabbing huge amounts of breached records and they then use them to try and automatically authenticate to services where you've reused passwords. So it'll sort of business as usual in that regard. And when I loaded it, like I always got to sort of decide, do I load it or not? And in fairness, there's a bunch of, for transparency, there's a bunch of other things I'm sitting on that are very similar where I've just gone, look, it's for various reasons, it's just not worth loading. Some of it a lot bigger too. But this was a case where it's like, okay, I think it needs to be loaded because there's a lot of stuff in there that hasn't been seen before. And I wrote a short blog post beforehand, and I was like, I know I'm going to get asked about things like, how do I see the password? What site was it on? What do I now do? So I will put the answers to all of these things in the blog post. So, of course, what do I get when I wake up this morning? Lots of questions about just that.
RTFM.
I didn't do any RTFMs, but I was very, very tempted to. I understand why people would ask that. I just hope that people understand why I don't want to store their passwords and have I been pwned in plain text to make them available.
Like, what could go wrong?
I also can't store them as hashes for a whole raft of different reasons, not least of which is think about 99% of the people using this site not even knowing what a hash is. There are just loads of reasons why this doesn't make sense in any way. So I always hesitate, but the thing I keep coming back to is every time I ask the question and I say to people, look, if there's an incident like this, and there's really nothing you can do beyond just being aware that these things happen and your data is circulating, should I load it or not? And people are always like, I would want to know. So I'm going to keep loading them. And frankly, if anyone's upset, there is always the option just to do nothing. You know, like, yeah, there's always the option just to go, okay, well, I'm upset. Good luck. Like, you know,
thanks.
You don't need to share your upsetness with me for... I guess I could offer them a refund or something like that.
That'd be really funny.
Okay, so last thing is I've got Netsparker sponsoring my blog this week, so big thanks to Netsparker. They've been there heaps. They're actually, and this was not scripted, and again, it's just a massive coincidental thing. We were talking about Netsparker just today because they beat you to writing the blog post that you're going to publish probably before this one.
Yeah, by the same time this goes up.
Do you want to talk about your blog post that Netsparker wrote?
And the weird thing is, it is literally like spooky. Yeah, so it shows that they're really on the
eerily
right.
Common. So right, they must be smart.
Yeah, they must be. Or I must be. Nah. Depends which way.
Depends which one goes out first, doesn't it?
But yeah, it was following on from the British Airways thing. For those that haven't seen, it's been pretty widespread. British Airways got hit by a Magecart, so they had hostile JavaScript loaded into their payment flow.
What's
Magecart? Magecart is like a gang that is doing lots of attacks like this, where they put hostile JavaScript into websites that then keylogs, and the goal is payment card pages.
Yeah.
So they're essentially card skimming, but with JavaScript, which is like the new way of card skimming, I guess, now. So the British Airways website, whilst it was a self-hosted file, it was like a different part, a different application. So,
it was a JavaScript file running on one British Airways site and then included in the other British Airways site, which was actually doing the card process.
Correct. And then obviously this other application, we don't know how yet, has been compromised somehow, and the JavaScript was changed to include the keylogger, which went onto the payment page, which exfiltrated all the card data. And we've seen similar attacks like this already this year. Ticketmaster for us in the UK was a huge one, which is why I have a shiny new credit card. Details skimmed.
Congratulations.
I didn't really want to tweet about that. So it's just like a really annoying scenario to be in. And it's like, so yeah, you just go to Ticketmaster, buy tickets, and then in the background, it's just like keylogging all of your stuff away. And then earlier this year, the British government and American and Aussie government as well, crypto-jacking one. They load JavaScript. The JavaScript is screwy. And you're then screwed because the JavaScript was screwy. And the fix to this is content security policy coupled with sub-resource integrity.
Because every one of these was a case of the website itself not having been compromised, but an external dependency that runs client-side was compromised. And so talk briefly about the CSP and SRI stuff that Netsparker wrote.
I wish I'd hit publish this morning now. So you couple these two things together. First of all, content security policy allows you to whitelist hosts, so you can lock down where script can be loaded from. So depending on the attack vector, how they get script in the page, you can only load script from like trusted locations. SRI is then, if I'm loading script from my CDN or my own application or wherever, and that is changed somehow, then I load the modified script from the trusted location, which was the CDN. So SRI, you basically just add a hash of the script into the script tag. So when the browser fetches the file, it does a hash of the file and compares it and says, great, this is exactly the file. But if anything changes, then of course the hash changes, and it can look and say, well, this is not the script we were expecting. I don't know what's different, but I know it is different, and therefore I will throw it away. And the real power of coupling them together is with CSP, you can say every script tag on this page must have SRI, and that's the final kind of piece of the puzzle, because what if a developer puts a script tag there and doesn't do this? It's an extra control to make sure that that policy can't be skipped. So you can really come full circle with CSP and SRI together and have absolute control. So you can still load from third parties, because I load all of my script from a CDN. They do it for free, they're faster, no bandwidth cost, etc. Client might already have it cached. There's loads of really good reasons to do it, but you give them so much power. It's kind of like the having an extension thing, right? You're giving the control to some third party and hoping that they do everything the right way and don't screw you. And this is what keeps happening. And it's become a really common thing now. So I say really common. We've had like four international headlines this year, so I think that counts as
common. Can, if you can publish it before I publish this, I'll link to your blog post right after I link to Netsparkers, because they're actually paying money for this week as well. So thank you very much for watching. Just before we go, I'll just sort of spin the camera around just so we can see where we are here, because this is really nice. And for the... Oh, geez, for the Aussies. This is...
You want a hand there? Are you okay?
I got stuck in the boat. So we're on South Stradbroke Island, which is there. This is nice. Boat there. And, yeah, just like water and wallabies and...
So amazing if you fell in now.
Would you like that? No falling in. All right. Thanks for watching, guys. Well, hey, we'll be in Sydney next week. So we'll do it again in Sydney.
Yeah, do it again in Sydney.
All right. See you guys. Bye-bye.